people have these beautiful development plans that they write on a piece of paper, and it's always in their drawers because they say life gets in the way.
A sponsor is one who's going to say, I've got influence, I've got relationships, I've got political capital. I am going to ensure that I leverage my network and I leverage my position to help you get what you want and to ensure that you succeed. So I'm not only going to open the door, fight for you behind the door, I'm going to walk you through it, and I'm going to be with you on the other side. Women are over-mentored. There's a lot of us telling us and advising us on what to do, and that's not important. I've had incredible mentors in my life that, mostly men, by the way, who have been so supportive of me. But it's the sponsorship that gives me access to opportunity that I may not have otherwise.
Welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast, hosted by Andy LaPata, the show where Andy and his guests explore the many ways in which relationships impact business decisions, make leaders' jobs easier, and help you to progress your career.
Hello, and welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast. I'm Andy LaPata. Thank you very much for joining me. One of the themes that I come back to on a relatively regular basis on the podcast, and it's something that has consumed me at various points in my career in terms of the clients that I've worked with, is the topic of gender and ensuring that there's equal representation and equal opportunity for women as well as men in all forms of business life. And of course, when you're looking at creating that equal opportunity and leveling the playing field, if you like, then professional relationships lie at the heart of that. So we're revisiting that topic again today, and with someone who really is in a position to give some fantastic insights into that particular conversation. She's an accomplished chief executive officer, a speaker and consultant, and she's the author of a new book, as so many of my guests are, funnily enough, and the host. And her book is called Is In Her Own Voice, A Woman's Rise to CEO. She was the first female CEO at Linkage, a global leadership development firm that's dedicated to changing the face of leadership. And she's very recently started as the CEO of Catalyst, which is a New York-based nonprofit focusing on accelerating progress for women in the workplace. She's not just done that. She's been featured in publications like The Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, Forbes, and like me, Psychology Today. And now the Connected Leadership Podcast. To cap it all off, thank you so much for joining me, Jennifer McCollum.
Thank you, Andy. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with finding out a little bit about your own journey, Jennifer. So can you tell us a little bit about your journey to CEO, and particularly with a lens on the work that you do and the topic of this conversation? Along that journey, how did your gender help or hinder you?
I don't want to go too far back, but I will say I grew up in the corporate world in the 90s and 2000s, where by all accounts, it was really hard to be a woman in a professional environment. We were told what to wear. We were told how to speak. There was pay inequity. There was sexual harassment. It was just tough. And so I learned how to work around all of the external biases that existed and overcame a lot of those. In the last 20 years or so, I started, as I advanced in my career, I started leading business units in the leadership space, first as a consultant, then at publicly traded companies. And things did get easier for me as I rose the corporate ladder. But what I learned as the CEO of Linkage through our 25 years of data and research and insight was that a lot of the external bias has actually become internalized. And the path to advancement for women is different as they rise in leadership. We face additional hurdles. And I got really interested, really over the last 20 years, in supporting the rise of women leaders, any woman who had the aspiration to lead, and ensuring that the systems around them were walking alongside them, the executives, the organizations that they worked for, to support their rise as well. So that's really been my dedication for the last, 8 to 10 years of my leadership career as a CEO.
So you said that external biases became internalized. Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, no, for sure. So I'll give you a very specific example. So when I grew up, it was at a very large organization, and it became very obvious to me, because we spoke about it, that I was being paid differentially from my male peers. So instead of going to the organization and raising it and asking it, I decided that I was just going to put my head down and work harder and harder and harder to prove my value so people would see that I was worthy of the same salary. That's one of the largest hurdles that women face, this misperception that if we just work harder and prove ourselves, then suddenly good things will happen to us, mm-hmm. whether it's the promotion or the pay or the recognition. So that's an example. I moved through my career in the first 10 years. And yes, I got promoted. And yes, my pay increased. But it wasn't any different than the men who had started at a different point than me. So that's one example of I internalized that bias saying, well, if I'm not being paid fairly, it must be something I'm doing wrong. So that's an example of how women internalize it.
Right. Okay. So that's what I wanted to just clarify, is that what you meant by internalizing and externalizing. And that paints a very clear picture. It's interesting, just as an aside, when your thought process of, if I just put my head down and do a good job, I'll be recognized for it. That may play out more in terms of gender. And there's some interesting conversations about that. But I think that's very common across the board. And we talked about this in a recent podcast. When I talk about professional relationship strategy for your career, I talk about people's belief that if I do a good job, I'll get promoted. And yet the evidence and the research bears out that's not the case. And there's a famous piece of research known as PIE, which stands for performance, image, and exposure, which are the three elements that go into promotion. And performance only accounts for 10%. Image, what people perceive of your performance, is 30, and exposure, who perceives it, is 60%. So that goes very much to what you're saying. But I wonder how much more prevalent that is.
Can I just interject? Yeah. I have actually never heard that three-part framework, but it aligns really nicely to some of the research that I quote in my book, which is, again, the external bias, where men tend to be, well, so there's this performance potential bias, where women, by and large, tend to be rated as higher performers. You could argue that that's the more objective view, but men are rated higher in terms of potential. So I'm wondering if that exposure piece, that relationship piece, is really, and so men are getting promoted at a faster rate because of those potential scores. So that is consistent. That's a great example of external bias.
Yeah.
What women need to do more effectively is to make the ask, advocate, self-promote, so that they will have that same type of exposure that men have had very naturally and done very well, by the way, over many, many centuries.
The other thing that I think it ties into that I quote quite regularly is there's a book called Business Networking and Sex, No, Not That Kind. That's the actual full title, by Dr. Ivan Meisner. And in the book, Ivan shares his process of VCP, and he uses it to demonstrate the difference between the genders. And VCP is the order in which things should happen in building a relationship. So it's visibility, credibility, profitability. So you get people to know you first, to trust you, then you get what you're looking for, or ask what you're looking for. And when he talks about the gender difference, and I have quoted this in front of so many women's networks with my heart beating, thinking someone's going to shoot me down, and all I see are nodding heads and smiling faces of recognition. But what men will tend to do will be jump from visibility to profitability and worry about the credibility later. If I see something, I'm going to grab it and ask for it, and then we'll build the relationship at a later point. What women tend to do, and I like talking about masculine and feminine because I think we all have a mix of different traits, but what women or the feminine approach is go visibility, credibility. So it's, how are you? What's important to you right now? How can I serve you? How can I help you? But then get stuck there and never ask for the help that they need. And this has been borne out in so many other talks I've heard and books I've read. Beyond the Boys Club by Suzanne Doyle Morris really shares this very, very well as well. But I wonder if all of this ties together to go to what you're saying, where women have internalized, I don't ask for what I need. That goes with Ivan's VCP process very much so, and that difference between the genders.
You're actually hitting on two additional hurdles. So I talked about proving your value. The ones you're talking about now align to what we call recognized confidence. And then the next one is making the ask. So recognized confidence is really about that visibility. It's not that, it's very well researched that women and girls, frankly, by the time they're kind of 10, 11, 12 years old, when you look at the gender difference, by and large, their confidence levels are far lower than boys going into the teenage years. So we've kind of stopped trying to beat confidence into women. Back in the, you know, 90s and 2000s, it was like, we need more confidence and executive presence, and you need to look and talk and act a certain way. We've really stopped talking about that in our work. Now it's about, how do others recognize you in your excellence? And over time, that will build your confidence. And that leads to, how can women self-promote? And that's that visibility piece that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Far more effective. How can you shine a light on yourself? And if you're not comfortable doing that, can you find an ally? Maybe it's your boss. Maybe it's a peer. Maybe it's your mentor or your sponsor. Can you find someone to shine that light on you and borrow confidence from them until you feel it in yourself? So that's that visibility piece. And the other one is making the ask. And I love, is it okay if I just tell you one more story?
Please. Yeah, please go for it.
So I talk to women all the time who will say, you know, I feel like I deserve that promotion, or I was promised that, you know, promotion weeks or months or years ago, but my boss, I mean, I'm doing my job and his job or her job, and, you know, that promotion is not coming. And, you know, my perspective is, well, you know, how are you making that ask and making it visible? Are you asking for what you feel you deserve or what you really, really want? And so women tend to water down their ask. And again, this is very well researched. Women and men will make the ask, but women will retreat very quickly if they're told no. So how do you actually create the business praise, create the environment, create the timing and the place to make that ask and be willing, if the feedback is no, see it as an opportunity to go back and repackage or reposition it? Again, external bias is that when women do that, sometimes there's a negative backlash, and then the perception is they are too aggressive and therefore unlikable. So that's, we're toggling these internal and external biases all the time.
You mentioned finding an ally and someone to support you on that journey. And I did want to talk to you about allyship. Actually, I think there's two different angles to look at, and that is finding, it's almost three in a way, because there is the formal allyship of a mentor or a sponsor. And I think it'd be interesting to explore the role of sponsors, particularly. We've talked about mentors a lot on various podcasts, and obviously, hint, hint, there's a book about it out now. But maybe we can touch on that, but it'd be good to dig a little bit deeper in sponsorship, which we don't talk about as often. And then there is the female allyship. And one of the things I've heard a lot over the years, and I don't know how much it's changing, is that there hasn't necessarily always been the support from women in senior positions for those coming up behind them, because they feel they've got to protect their position almost. And I think maybe we can talk about that. And then, what does good allyship from a man look like? What's a man's role in this journey? So let's take those one at a time. So perhaps you can talk a little bit about sponsorship, the role of sponsors within an organization, whether they're male or female. I don't think that necessarily matters. Maybe you can address that. And if you want to touch on mentoring, feel free as well.
Oh, this is such a meaty topic. I love that you introduced it. So first of all, let's talk about, regardless of the spectrum of gender, all of us can be allies. Some of us can be coaches and mentors. And there's this kind of exclusive club that can be sponsors, because to be a sponsor, you have to have that political capital and that influence to really drive the promotion or the advancement of any gender, frankly. So I'll give you, I love painting this in stories. Allyship, women need allies. And frankly, here's an example. I'm a new executive at our acquired company about a year and a half ago. And I'm sitting around the executive table. I'm not full of confidence because these people have been together for a long time. I've come in as an acquired CEO. And I'm talking to the chief knowledge officer of the acquiring company. And we're having a fantastic conversation when the CEO calls the meeting to order again. And this person, whose name is Alex, kind of blurted out what we had been talking about. And the CEO says, Alex, that's a fantastic idea. Tell me more about that. And he said, I'm actually not going to tell you more. Jennifer's going to tell you more because it was her idea. Now, that lifts, as a new executive, it fills me with confidence and a feeling of inclusion, a feeling of belonging. Any one of us can do that. We have to be awake and aware. Okay, mentorship and coaching, and this is your area of expertise. Ideally, your manager would be a coach. We know that managers don't necessarily have all that capability. They're formal and informal coaches. coaches are helping you to be better at specific skill sets that you aspire to develop into. If you have coaching capability, you can be a coach. Mentors are, hey, I've got experience in this, and I'm going to help you learn from my experiences. So you want to get through that door? Let me tell you the mistakes I made. Let me tell you what's going to work. Let me tell you the pitfalls you're going to have. I'm going to help lead you there. But here's what a sponsor does. And a sponsor is one who's going to say, I've got influence. I've got relationships. I've got political capital. I am going to ensure that I leverage my network and I leverage my position to help you get what you want and to ensure that you succeed. So I'm not only going to open the door, fight for you behind the door, I'm going to walk you through it, and I'm going to be with you on the other side. Women are over-mentored. There's a lot of us telling us and advising us on what to do, and that's not important. I've had incredible mentors in my life that, mostly men, by the way, who have been so supportive of me. But it's the sponsorship that gives me access to opportunity that I may not have otherwise.
I think that's a really interesting insight, really useful insight. So if you're a woman looking to move your way through into the upper echelons of the organization you're in, into a more senior position elsewhere, you know, Ruth Gotian, who you and I both know, my co-author and I have had many conversations when we wrote the book about whether someone should ask someone to mentor them or not. What's your view on sponsorship? Should people be stepping forward to offer sponsor others? Should you be asking people to sponsor you, or can it be both ways?
Yeah, it's such an important question. And again, because you're a mentor, you and Ruth, just mentorship experts, I think it's actually much easier to ask for a mentorship or someone to help you along based on their experience. And I'll tell you a mentorship story very quickly. Alan Mulally, who was the former CEO of Boeing and Ford, and I write about this in detail in the book, has been such an important mentor in my life. As I was a first-time CEO, he helped me leverage what he calls the working together business and our leadership and management system that really helped me transform my prior organization, Linkage. Now, Alan is one of the most important people in my professional life, and he's become a personal friend as well. Sponsorship, you have to earn. I could approach Alan and say, would you give me a few minutes? This is how it started. Would you give me a few minutes of your time to help me understand your working together management system? Because I'd like to apply it. And he was willing to give me a few minutes. But over the course of developing that relationship, he gave me hours and days and weeks. Sponsorship is different. Sponsors ideally would see you in your excellence or in your potential and say, I am willing to bet, you know, my reputation on your success, and I'm going to help you. Now, if you have that relationship and it requires visibility, it requires trust, and that's why women have got to ensure that they're building the relationships in the network, sponsorship is easier to ask for. So my sponsorship story was Tom Kolditz, who was on my board at Linkage, and he was a very famous author, general, leadership guru. He taught leadership at many universities. He came to me and said, I see an opportunity for you that you don't even see for yourself. And I am going to ensure that I open the door at the Marshall Goldsmith 100 Coaches organization. I am going to sponsor you into the organization because it's good for you and it's good for Linkage. That's what sponsorship did for me. And that's how I met Marshall Goldsmith, which is how I met Alan Mulally.
One of the things I've noticed there, and it goes back to something I mentioned in my very long-winded question earlier, is that your mentor and your sponsor that you've just referenced are both men. So, A, is it important for women to find female sponsors and mentors, or does it not matter? And secondly, are there enough women stepping forward in that role?
Yeah, so you raised this earlier. It's such a good question. And I mean, I think we have to look at the truth of what is today. And when you look at senior leaders, kind of at the VP level and above, all the way through to the CEOs, almost 80% of them are men. As you rise, obviously, there's fewer and fewer women at the top. So as I moved through my career and I looked up for help, there were just far fewer women there. And in that era, the 90s and 2000s, thankfully it's changing, but there also weren't enough women that I aspired to emulate. I mean, the women who had made it were making massive sacrifices. Many of them didn't have families or children. If they did have a partner, they were likely working from home as the secondary, as the family support system. That it didn't match my life. So as I looked up, I had no choice but to really engage with a lot of men. So what has happened in the last 10 to 20 years? As there are more women in positions of power and influence, what we want the shift to be is, you know, we want women to be helping women. We want men to be helping women. And frankly, when we get to 50-50, we should all be helping each other. Yeah. The truth is there are more today than there are, you know, white men to fill them. So when you look at diversity of leadership, starting with gender as the largest underrepresented population in leadership, we have to be supporting each other and supporting the rise of women in all underrepresented populations.
You remind me of a former guest on the podcast and someone who's become a good friend of mine, Miranda Braun, who runs a diversity business focused on helping women and people generally from ethnic minorities to advance their careers. And she talks about when she started her career and she was on the trading floor. And this was in an interview for the Financial Times Guide. And she said to me, she approached the only senior black woman in the bank. And that woman said to her, I don't have the expertise to help you because you want to go on the trading floor. And there were no women on the trading floor. There were very few people of color. So in fact, she had to go to a white man to be her mentor. And I think that taps into what you just said, is people have got to be there. One of the other things we talk about is the minority tax, which is where if you are one of the few senior women in an organization, the demands on your time for mentoring and perhaps sponsorship are going to be greater than your male colleagues. Is that something that you've experienced as well? And how do you manage that?
This is a trend that really became a lot more visible during COVID. And again, this is not my research, but it's very well researched that you think about kind of the day job of the woman, which is kind of your 9 to 5, although none of us work 9 to 5. And then you look at what we call the second shift. And during COVID, it spiked at an additional 3 hours on average per day for women than men, looking at the primary responsibility for the childcare, the home care, the elder care. But what you're getting at now in terms of the tax is what I call, or we call, the third shift. And the third shift is the additional expectation that women tend to have and play out in terms of the mental health care, the DEI responsibilities, the supporting the employees through prioritization during COVID or mental health challenges. So the expectation that women are going to be the DEI experts and women are going to be the sponsors and women are going to be running the programs and women are going to be doing a lot more of the volunteering. And that's called the third shift. And that's something that we need to make a lot more visible and change, because whether you're a woman or, you know, an ethnic or racial minority, the burden on us to try and solve the problems alone simply is unrealistic. That's why I love what Catalyst is doing. It's called MARC, Men Advocating Real Change. And we're working with huge organizations, global organizations, who are really committed to ensuring that men, who are still the majority in positions of power, really see not only the benefit to the organization and to the individuals, but the benefit for themselves when they're able to become a lot more aware and support the advancement of people who don't look like them.
Enhance your mentoring skills with the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring by Andy LaPata and Dr. Ruth Gotian. Secure your copy early by pre-ordering today on Amazon or your preferred bookseller.
So that takes me back to something I asked you earlier, which is, what does good male allyship look like? You gave one example, and a very good one, of where the CEO called on you to share your idea rather than taking it for himself, which is a story I hear the reverse of happening quite a lot, where, you know, people take credit for ideas that aren't theirs. So what else, if I want to be a good ally, what do I need to be doing and what does that look like? Whether I'm in a senior executive role and in a position to exert change from that position, or like me, I'm outside that organizational structure, or even in a junior role, just in the way that I interact with women, what does male allyship look like in its various guises?
And that's exactly why I painted that broad spectrum from allyship to sponsorship, because no matter where you sit, you can make a difference. And I actually use the story of my husband, who's an individual contributor in a large commercial bank. And he said, look, Jennifer, I know this is important to you, and I know you're writing this book, and I know this is the work you do, but there's really nothing that I can do. I don't have any direct reports. I'm not a manager. What can I do? And so that was a perfect entree to say, well, honey, you have all of these built up over many decades. And when you look at your team, there are no women and actually no people of color on that team. So you can look one or two or three levels below and identify a couple people who don't look like you. Let's start with women. And you can start to mentor them, advise them, support them, offer your expertise. And so, I mean, I'm so proud of him because the other day he said, Jennifer, I need to sign one of your books. And I said, okay, why? And he said, because I'm having lunch with Tanya. And Tanya's mentored for the last couple of years and she's up for a promotion. So that's just such a simple, perfect example. He was excited about it. She's obviously gaining from it. So those are the little things you can do when you notice someone is speaking but not being heard, or someone is not speaking because they feel like they can't get in. It's a great example to stop and say, I'd actually want to hear from Julia. And can we just pause for a moment because she's got something really important to say. So those are little things. Yeah. As you move up the ladder, are macro things as well, which we can talk about next if you'd like.
Yeah, please do. I think, first of all, to say those little things are so important because it's those little touches. The man's perspective, I'm going to play a bit of the devil's advocate here. There's a fine balance to be had in those scenarios between being supportive and being patronizing. And one of the scary things for men is, am I going to be accused of, you know, the word mansplaining keeps coming in, but that's not the right word for this. That is something different. But am I going to be accused of sort of treating women differently and in a patronizing way when I'm trying to do the right thing? So how do we tread that fine line?
Yeah, it's such an important point because I've had many men say to me, like, one, you know, if I do the wrong thing, then there's backlash on me. Or, you know, am I going to be worked out of my own job? And I think there's a lot of fear that, you know, there's a lack of abundance in terms of the mentality that we have. And what I say to that is, you know, actually, all of us, especially the women, need to really assume positive intent. So when a man is trying to do the right thing, you know, don't beat him down for it. You know, say like, you know, thank you for allowing me the opportunity. And if you mess up, it's okay. You know, let's just talk about it. And I think the more open we can be around, like, listen, I've noticed if a man were to say to me, like, I noticed you were pretty quiet in that meeting. Is there anything that I can do to help you? Or, you know, you gave me a really good idea, but it's not coming out. Like, how can I support you? Any types of conversations like that should be met with huge open arms and welcome, even if you're not doing it perfectly. In terms of the lack of abundance mentality, and I hear this all the time from our clients, our prospective clients, you know, if we focus disproportionately on women, then how are the men going to feel? And this is where I think executive sponsorship programming. Now, this is taking us all the way up now to sponsorship. Many organizations feel like we can just figure this out on our own. People will magically become sponsors. They'll know how to do it. But in reality, it takes some structure, some process, some capability building, some very open conversations to help men understand, what does it look like to engage appropriately? And by appropriately, I mean in a way that serves you and the woman and the organization so that we can build connections between people who don't look like us so we can get to know each other, build the relationships, have the visibility, and then we can change together the structure or the metrics and the representation in the organization.
The founder of the National Speakers Association, and I've mentioned this on the podcast before, it's very powerful when you talk about abundance mentality. A very famous speaker called Cavett Robert was asked why he was founding an association of his competitors. And he said, the important thing is not to worry about the size of our own slice of the pie, but to make the pie bigger as a whole. And when you talk about abundance mentality, the ability to surround yourselves with people of greater talent than you have at the moment, people of a diverse range of views who will bring different perspectives into play and so on, makes the pie bigger. And it's so important to recognize that and have the confidence to think I belong in that upper crust. but yeah, you know, I still belong there and I'm worthy of my place. And the only time you should feel threatened if you don't think you're good enough. And that's something else to address, isn't it?
Well, and you're hitting it, the foundational, what we call the hurdles to the advancement of women. And it's called the inner critic. And the inner critic, we all have one, but it's actually far louder for women. And it is the hurdle that amplifies all the other one. And it's that kind of that inner voice of judgment. And it does say things to us like, you're not good enough, or you're not worthy, or you shouldn't ask for that raise or promotion, or you shouldn't speak up in that meeting. And that voice can really paralyze us from taking action. So I'll have another story about that. Just recently, I was on a podcast with two professors, one man and one woman, and we were talking about this inner critic and this voice, and we were the two of us were talking about how that voice has prevented us from taking action. And the man said, it must be so hard to be you. He said, I don't hear that voice. That voice doesn't paralyze me. I don't hear that. I don't say things to myself like that. So I think it's important when you say, like, the I'm not worthy voice is very loud for women.
Just to flag this for people listening, if that resonates with you and imposter syndrome is something you struggle with, a couple of years ago, we focused on it in an episode with Caroline Flanagan and Sajna Rahman. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, so you can go and dig a little bit deeper on that, because I know it is a big issue. And I hear you say resonates particularly strongly for women, and I believe that. It does. It is prevalent in men as well. I don't think every man is that alpha male, bullish, I'm perfect. And, you know, I suffer from imposter syndrome all the time, and I'm sure I'm not alone in that. And so it's something we need to manage. But I think that's a core message with a lot of what we've talked about. I think a lot of what you said would resonate for anyone listening, but it's perhaps more prevalent in women than men in general. And that when that plays out over a large community of people, that has a big impact on the statistics.
I'm actually really glad that you said that, because I think just as we've been talking about external bias pointed at women, I think it's important to talk about external bias pointed at men as well, mm-hmm. with the expectation that men are supposed to be confident, take care of everyone, have all the answers, you know, and hide their feelings, not be emotional. And so I think in some ways, the expectations that we come into the world with, let alone the professional world, it's not helping men either. Yeah. And there's a very funny, I don't know how funny it is, but there's a story in the book about when I was accused, when I was called early in my career, I was called a cupcake with a razor blade inside. Ooh. With that cupcake being this kind of, you know, warm, kind, collaborative, you know, lovely exterior, which frankly is the expectation of women, with that, you know, ambitious, aggressive, competitive, kind of killer instinct of the razor blade, which honestly is the expectation of the masculine. And when we think about leadership, we think more about the razor blade than we do about the cupcake. And I've spent a lot of time on stages talking about how do we integrate that cupcake and the razor blade across the spectrum of gender and make it okay to bring both the masculine and the feminine into the workplace.
You've touched on something that I feel really strongly about. When I see how business women are represented on television programs in the UK, it drives me mad, because I see always a masculine look. You know, on Dragon's Den, you call it Shark Tank in the US, we had a dragon who was always known for her huge shoulder pads. And it was that Dallas look from the 1980s. And for me, it just sent the wrong message. And another woman that was on it was always quite aggressive. And to me, you know, I got to sense check my own thoughts when I do this, because I don't want to be saying, well, women should be feminine, you know, but I felt it was sending out a signal that if you're going to be a successful woman in business, you need to become masculine and not just be yourself. And I think whether you are male or female or transgender, whether you are whatever you're doing, you should be yourself. And if your personality is alpha, be alpha. If your personality is not, then still be yourself. And we need to create a narrative that allows that to happen. And that's what we are not getting in popular culture, certainly in the UK, probably not in the US either.
Well, it's interesting. You're actually hitting on another hurdle in the book called the brand and presence hurdle. And we actually have shifted our thinking on this pretty dramatically since COVID. So COVID, the pandemic, allowed us to reconsider some of the ways we were thinking about helping women overcome the hurdles. Now, going back to your dragons, it may be that the aggressive dragon and the shoulder pad dragon were feeling incredibly authentic operating in that context. Fabulous. If you are anyone, and I will speak from the perspective of a woman, who feels like you have to contort or assimilate or be someone that does not feel authentic to you. And again, early in my career, I was told what I couldn't wear. I was told how I needed to show up. I was finding myself, you know, whether it was the leadership or the culture, in some cases, not feeling like I could be myself. And that provides an enormous burden on your ability to perform. So the question is, and this is, I don't know if you know, there's a woman named Caroline Wonga, and she's the CEO of Essence Magazine here in the United States. She was the former head of DEI at Target. And she is such a powerful presence, you know, an African-American woman who's about 6 feet tall. And she said, I took my cardigan sweaters and I burned them all. And I came to the office, you know, over the course of weeks and months at Target, shifting how I showed up so I could feel more authentic. And here is her message to all of us. If you can't be who you are, where you are, change where you are, not who you are. And so that brand and presence is more about authenticity now. Can you show up in whether it's the way you look, talk, and dress, or whether it's the way you act and talk? Can you be who you are? And I've made a commitment. I will never be at another organization where I don't feel like I can be completely my authentic self.
I think that's brilliant. I love that quote as well. And to clarify, my problem was not with those individual women, but the narrative that we were being fed by popular culture that only shows women looking like that in business. And we need to see women of all types of personality and men, because also The Apprentice, both in the US, because we know who led that, and in the UK, it's bullish alpha male bullies. And it's all about selling people against each other. And it's just the wrong message for anyone interested in business at any age. I'm aware of the time, and I'm aware of the promise I made that we would talk about the macro elements of allyship. So why don't we talk about that? Then I've got one more question if we've got time, just to round off.
Perfect. So we started that, you know, that spectrum of allyship to sponsorship, because I want all of your listeners to know that no matter where you sit on that spectrum, you can make a difference. When you get to that upper echelon of sponsorship, it tends to be those of us who are in the executive ranks who really have the power to make change. So we know that the very best of our organizations are one that focus on four specific levers, and I'll just go through them quickly. And one is around the culture. Are we creating a culture? And you can measure this and you can, you know, work against this, but it does take leadership from the top. Are we creating a culture where it feels like the people can add their uniqueness and they feel like they belong? And that's starting with modeling at the top. The second is talent systems. Is there equity in our talent systems? So I talked about earlier in my career, you know, we weren't measuring it back then. There was very little equity in the talent systems. We know that pay inequity is still very real, especially for women of color. So are we measuring the talent acquisition process, the pay process, the promotion process, the succession process? Are we building equity into our benefits, as an example? The third thing is what we call, this is the hardest one, actually, executive commitment and executive sponsorship. So whether it's formal or informal, are those in the positions of power not only saying the right things, are they doing the right things? That's why I really like formal sponsorship programs. I like formal measurement and formal accountability. It just helps with the belief that real action is happening. And then the last one is development, leadership development. Are we differentially focused on not, you know, all of us need to be developed as highly capable leaders, but we have to disproportionately focus on those who have been marginalized or underrepresented to help us, whether it's women or whether it's, you know, race or ethnicity, to help us overcome those hurdles and accelerate faster.
You mentioned the formal sponsorship programs. I would add to that, if I may, that you can't just put them in place. You've got to build them into the DNA of the organization, and people have to know they're there. They have to know how to access them. They have to know who qualifies, and they have to know what's involved. Because unless it's transparent, it's accessible, and it is lived and breathed, then it's box ticking.
I'm so glad you said that, Andy, because at Linkage, my prior company, we work with companies all over the world. And the hardest part of a sponsorship program is to help the sponsors understand why they need it. But what happens is year after year through, and most of the times we do sponsorship in addition to leadership development and we bring them together, over time, they start to see how impactful and beneficial it is for them, right? Not just for the women or the organization. There's this whole debate about, are we doing all of this DEI work because it's the right thing to do or because it builds, you know, the business outcomes that we know are very well researched? And I would say it's actually both of those things. But what's even more important is the benefit to the sponsors, the benefits to the mentors, the benefits to the allies themselves. And that's kind of a surprise, like my husband going back to, wait a minute, this is really good for me too.
Yeah. And I know I said I had another question, but I think that's a great note to finish on. We have covered so much today and actually probably not gone in the direction I intended to, but one that really gripped me and hopefully gripped people listening. So Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me on the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Well, thank you, Andy. It's been a very special 45 minutes together.
Well, it was a very special 45 minutes indeed. And I hope it was special for you. So much to take away from that, as always with these conversations. A lot of it about getting to those leadership positions, getting the support needed. The one question I didn't ask Jennifer, and, you know, maybe it's for a future conversation, maybe it's covered in the book, was about the particular challenges faced once women are in those leadership positions. But I didn't feel that with the time we have available, unfortunately, I could give Jennifer the time to do that, give an answer to that justice. Maybe that's something for a conversation on LinkedIn. If you're interested in that, just comment on the post and let's start a conversation around it. And I'll be happy to tag Jennifer and we'll see if she'll join us in that conversation. So I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it. Make sure other people get to hear this. If you're part of a women's network in your office, share the link as well there. That would be really helpful. But make sure male allies get to hear it as well. It's not just for women to listen to this one. And whatever you do, join us again next week for another episode of the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Leadership Podcast. If you found this valuable, please subscribe, tell your colleagues and friends, share on social media, and post a review on the podcast channel you use to listen to it. And of course, join us again soon for another interesting interview and great connected leadership tips.